Right? We walked to the doors every day, and it wasn't, what do we know? I think the question we would always ask ourselves is, what do we know that no longer serves us? And I think that's what sounds more of what's going on in the military right now. You know, Mike and I call it the disease of nostalgia. We've always done it this way, right? Like that archaic way of thinking is just it, that's about burying teams, companies, and programs, right? It's having the humility to say, you know what? I've always thought about this. I might need to rethink this because it no longer serves us.
Welcome back for another week, team. This is Drew and Alex here. This week, we're stepping outside of the military once again into the world of NASCAR, which I think for a lot of folks is probably a world that they're wholly unfamiliar with. Alex?
We got a duo here. Sean Pete and Mike Metcalf are the co-founders of Deck Leadership and co-authors of 12 Second Culture. They are working to transform the modern workplace by uncovering opportunities for diversity, efficiency, culture, and kindness, rooted in the principles of a pit crew experience. Between the two of them, they have over 25 years in NASCAR and have worked with numerous Fortune 500 companies implementing this DEC philosophy. They are also co-head pit crew coaches, as well as directors of culture and community at Trackhouse Racing. Sean played 4 years in the Ivy League at Dartmouth College, where he picked up a double major in psychology and sociology. I should specify, played hockey for 4 years at Dartmouth, followed by 8 years in the minor leagues. And a chance meeting with a fan then afforded him an opportunity to work in NASCAR as a jackman on a pit crew for the next 12 years, during which he was part of the Red Bull Racing crew that won the 2008 World Pit Crew Championships. Mike was a fullback for Appalachian State University football and then entered the world of motorsports in 2006 as a member of a NASCAR pit crew. In addition to competing, he started coaching as well in 2012. He's also very engaged with several volunteering efforts in his local community, which he mentions a little bit of in the episode.
So I think the interesting thing there, well, there's a couple of interesting things, but first and foremost, neither one of these guys, I should say, grew up in NASCAR. And that was something that was, we dug in a little bit, just this idea. And you see this a lot if you're around, I think, this sport and this culture. Folks from other sports, other backgrounds coming in and being very successful in NASCAR pit crews. And I think that there's a lot of corollaries that could be drawn there for folks with, you know, different backgrounds coming into the military and some of the lessons learned from both Sean and Mike in that regard. The other thing that's interesting about this episode, and you'll hear Sean tell this story at the very end, but I will preface it as well, is just how this episode came about. So my mom and my sister were on vacation in France, and I got a call from my mom telling me this story about how my sister, she used the term wrecked, but I think more just dented the rental car that they had in this tiny, tiny French village. And the other two people staying in their tiny hotel just happened to be Sean and his wife. And Sean, having a background in NASCAR pit crew, happened to be available to help fix the car, make sure it was running fine, basically saved the day, saved everyone's lives. So the story goes. Mom calls me. You will never believe who I just ran into. You guys are going to get along so great. You should totally talk to him. You should totally have him on the podcast. And so here we are. So Mom, this one is for you. Stick around to the very end and you guys will hear the full story of how Sean saved my mom's life.
I think you guys will find this one pretty interesting. There's some obvious discussion of like the strength and conditioning of NASCAR and what it takes to be a pit crew member and perform under those conditions. There's also the cognitive element of the time pressure and the money pressure and all those things. But unsurprisingly, if you listen to this podcast for any length of time, it pretty quickly gets into the culture aspect of how you build high performing teams and get them to achieve at the highest level possible. And that's where we really get into the valuable stuff, I think, is all of that.
Well, the other thing too, I'll add is that most of the times when we do our sort of X's and O's episodes, we jokingly tell people to pull out a pen and write things down, because I think there's a lot to take away when we dive into sets and reps and these sorts of things. But the conversation with Sean and Mike is absolutely full of fantastic quotes, fantastic examples of how you guys can take these principles of this 12-second culture, this deck philosophy, and implement it at your organizations, wherever that might be, military or civilian. So definitely a lot to take away from this. As always, we'll put as much as we can into the show notes, and we'll leave a lot of links that you guys can use to get in touch with these guys. So enjoy. Okay, I mean, for context, and I'm sure you guys hear this all the time, but Formula One comes out on Netflix, right? Now everyone's a Formula One fan. So when I think of a pit crew experience, I think of just like, okay, they're done, 2 seconds. But having grown up in Charlotte, been around the Hall of Fame, done this sort of like, you know, seen what that looks like, my assumption is that virtually no one that listens to this will have any real clue what NASCAR and specifically NASCAR pit crews do. Can you guys just walk through that? So the car comes in, go.
Yeah, Jackman jumps in front of it, has to lift a 3,500 pound race car with one stroke of the jack. Now we are also single lug. The tire changers have to engage that lug nut in under 2/10 of a second. Tire carrier's got to take two, what are they now, Mike, 50, 45 pound tires?
45
pound tires to the right side of the car, deliver one, run around to the back, have that mounted on the hub in under 0.8 seconds. There's a fuel person that has a 100 pound can of fuel. They have to have it plugged into a skidding race car in under 0.3 seconds. And now the goal, you know, we wrote a book called 12-Second Culture. Pit stops are in the eights now. You know, and the biggest, you know, Mike and I get that a lot. It's like, well, you guys aren't as fast as F1 teams. Well, we do it with five people. Yeah. F1 teams do it with 18, right? They have three people per wheel. We have one and a half, really. So that's where the big difference lies.
Well, because I think, and again, please correct me if I'm wrong here, but like you mentioned, they all have to start behind the wall, right? When the car rolls in?
Yes.
Yep. Okay, because with F1, they're like sitting there waiting for it.
It's counterintuitive to everything you were ever taught as a child not to play in traffic. Like, and you're not allowed to jump until it's one stall away. So you're jumping in front of a car at 55 miles an hour while all these other ones are coming around you. And Mike and I joke all the time, if you want to know what that's like, go out to the interstate, turn your back to rush hour traffic and let traffic blow by you inches off your heels. If that doesn't unnerve you, you have what it takes to pit race cars.
I mean, I say often we could take the top 50% of NASCAR pit crew people, shift them to the next Formula One race and they could hang. You wouldn't be able to do it the other way around. It's too physical. So it's just different.
Is that, I mean, I'm kind of just going down a rabbit hole here, but why is that? Is it just a product of the way the rules are written, or is it a completely different? I mean, the difference between the different, I guess, disciplines of auto racing, is it just a totally unique experience?
NASCAR kind of prides itself on being a little more primitive as a racing series. So showcasing physical human labor as in that intersection of how manufacturing of cars was made, I think is important to just the historical context of it. Whereas Formula One's a little bit more tech progressive. They're probably going to be the first ones to go electric and all that kind of stuff. So it's just different ideologies.
And I think the thinking and ideology of NASCAR was wrong, right? We used to, when Mike and I started, pit crews were seven. And they wanted to save teams money, so they made it six, and we refueled. We had a rebreather on the fuel. And then they wanted to save teams more money, so they went down to five, right? What they did is when you take seven people and turn it into five, you turn five people into specialists. Mm-hmm. Specialists cost a lot of money, right? Whereas F1, if you watch those guys warm up on Drive to Survive, it's like my dad doing calisthenics. Right? You know what I mean? Like, it's just a different world. And it's nothing against those guys, but like one guy pulls a wheel, one guy hits the lug, one guy puts a wheel on. Right? Our guys are pulling their own tires and throwing them back to the wall. And like it's just a different deal.
So you talked about like kneeling on the white line at the edge of the highway and cars flying past as far as you have what it takes to serve in a pit crew. That gets after like the cognitive stress management piece if you have what it takes to be on a pit crew. What are the physical prerequisites that you guys look for somebody that's able to do a job like that?
You know, I think, you know, we're the only team that doesn't like physically test, right? We're looking for world-class human beings, right? We're looking for things like intestinal fortitude, you know, intrinsic motivation, stuff like that, and enthusiasm, right? Now, do you have to have a certain level of physicality? Absolutely. You know, I think you look at our lineup, You know, we have linebackers from the Steelers, the Titans, and the Washington football team. We have All-American baseball players, swimmers. We've had two United States Navy SEALs. We've had a Marine. So it's like you said, one of the things we're finding is we're finding more wrestlers. And the reason for that is the way they change levels, right? Because everything is done under a linear plane on a race car. So someone's ability to change levels is going to be, is super important to us. So we're finding a little bit of success there.
I heard you guys mention this in another podcast you were on, and it really put into context to me, I guess into perspective for me, just how critical like being good at this is. And I'm going to get the numbers wrong, so I'll have you go through it, but just like the difference in 1/5 of a second or something like that, what that means at the speed of NASCAR race is going at money, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So like we, you know, we said at the start, our tire changers have to engage that lug nut in under 2/10 of a second. Right. So if you go ahead and blink your eyes, that's about 2/10 of a second. Now these cars are moving at about 190 feet per second. So 2/10 of a second equates to 56 feet, right? 56 feet at the Daytona 500 is the difference between first and sixth. And the difference in prize money between first and sixth is $1.1 million. That's what we have riding on the line, right? Like we operate right on the verge of what's humanly possible.
We were in Darlington. It's, I don't know, probably 4 years ago at this point, but 500 mile race, 11 or 12 pit stops. I can't remember, but for 10 of the 11 or 11 of the 12, we were class of the field. Came in first, went out first, came in third, went out first, came in second, went out first, came in first, went out first all night. The last stop, the two car was 0.4 faster than us. And they went from second to first. We went from first to second. So we were lights out for, you know, the majority of the race. A little tire rotation from our jackman, backup jackman at that, our primary guy was injured. And you would have thought, I mean, people wouldn't talk to us in the building. The driver was pissed, crew chief's pissed, GM's thinking, do we need to make some changes? Do we still have the right people? I mean, I couldn't believe, I was like, wow. I mean, I knew I was in an industry where it was tight and every 10th mattered, but that was the moment for me that I'll never forget that. Like how important every literal 10th of a second matters.
Well, you mentioned, I mean, I'm just like trying to get all my curiosity questions out of the way early. Cause this is, I mean, having grown up in Charlotte, even still, this is the first time I've been able to talk to like real life pit crew guys. You mentioned one of your guys getting injured. Can a jackman just like swap with a gas guy, or like, is it so specialized now that like guys can't sub in for each other, if that makes sense?
You have some rare occasions where someone learns two positions at a time, but pretty much from probably about, I'd say, Pete, maybe 5 months in, you got to pick a lane and go for it. You don't have time to try to train a multiple disciplines because you'll get behind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So as a disclaimer, before coming on this episode, I did a bunch of reading because I haven't watched a lot of NASCAR. I don't know a whole lot about how all of it works, but I was reading one and it talked a little bit about like what practice is, because the season's like 10 months long and like what goes into all of that. And it talked about like hours a day of practice. And then I was curious, like what practice looks like for a pit crew, like what the rhythm is. It talked about like watching film, like watching footage of them going through it and finding the errors and things like that. And then is there like dedicated conditioning that goes with that as well? And what does that look like?
Yeah. So it's, you know, one of the things that it is the toughest equation to solve is our strength and conditioning equation, right? People in this country talk about how long baseball season is. We're racing for 3 weeks before pitchers and catchers report. And we're racing for 3 more weeks after the World Series is awarded, right? So you think about that, like when you look at periodization and like trying to put muscle on these guys and girls, and like it's really difficult. So what does a week look like for us? Monday morning's pretty light. We will want you to come in and move. And what we're asking you to do is shake off the flight. So a lot of guys and girls will hit a CrossFit class or basically get sweaty, hop in the cold tub. And that's probably it for the day. Tuesday, they come in, watch film, and then we will practice, and then we have a workout. And what we do is we have two workout groups. We have one that's kind of strength CrossFit based, and we have another one that's speed and movement based. And basically what we do is we put those into 8-week blocks, and you can choose which block you're in for 8 weeks. And then everyone comes together. We work out together for a week. So we're all putting sweat on the floor together. And then you can choose which way you want to come out of that. You know what I mean? Because what we want is, what we fight is burnout, right? Like we have to make sure these people are engaged, right? So it's, that comes with a couple of things. That comes with strength coaches that know what they're doing, strength coaches that bring energy, right? And the other unique strength and conditioning equation for us is, if you look at a NASCAR pit stop, our athletes do the exact same thing every single time, right? So what that leads to is all these asymmetric movement patterns, right? So like making sure our athletes are supple and balanced is huge, because unlike baseball and football, you know, kids in this country don't grow up wanting to pit race cars. So it's not like there's 10,000 kids we can go find that'll do this, right? There's maybe 100. So we, you know, the care of our athletes is a huge, huge deal.
How do you, I mean, you mentioned just the singular task thing, and I'd be curious to hear how you guys answer this, just how you keep a team motivated for that long of a season when they, I mean, I don't want to say they just do the one thing over and over again, because obviously there's some differentiation, but like, is that a character trait you guys recruit for, or is that just sort of something that you deal with because it's in the background, is the nature of the sport, so to speak?
Yeah, he already talked about, you know, enthusiasm over aptitude. I mean, that's got to come from within. You know, if you have to motivate people every day to do their job, they're not going to be good at it. But if they want to do that and they look forward to it and they're excited about it and they're coming up with different ideas on how to get faster, now you got something. So yeah, that's a big part of recruiting. And that was part of it that we just missed early. We went for a talent first, made some big hires that, so we thought, and those are the ones that lasted the shortest amount of time. It was the people that had energy, and a lot of those people are still here. And that was, you know, we took over Chip Ganassi Racing's pit crew program like 10 years ago, and several of those guys are still going strong.
They don't come prepackaged, right? Like we have Division III athletes, right, that are at the top of level of something now, and they, you know, they feel great about that because, you know, they're at the top of the hill. We have guys that won the Super Bowl, right, that are out of the league, that need purpose. And now they love this because now they get to compete again. They get to be part of a team again. So it's certainly individual, and it doesn't always look the same. But like Mike said, you know, one of the big things that we bet on is enthusiasm. You know, we want people to bring energy through the door.
Well, and you mentioned early on that you guys, I mean, you recruit for that less so what you would assume would be kind of what you'd go after, which is just naturally big, strong, beefy people. Obviously that helps too, but how has that changed over maybe the last 10 or so years, maybe 20 years of NASCAR? Because in my mind, I mean, when I think NASCAR, I think old school, you know, I mean, we can go way back all the way to like moonshine, but I would imagine there's been a huge shift towards this now really athletic archetype. And the reason I ask that is because with our population in the military, I mean, obviously people have PT'd in the military forever, but there's this shift now towards this like athletic mindset. And I'm curious what that's looked like for you guys in NASCAR.
Well, I beat Mike into it only by a couple of years. And I was on the front side of athletes coming in. You know what I mean? Like I was the only athlete on a team of mechanics. Right. So I always joke, I tried for 16 years to try to make it to the NHL, and I made it to NASCAR in like 6 weeks. but you know, as the times continued to drop, right, when I got in, a great pit stop was 16 seconds, right? Towards the end of five lug stops, they were 9 seconds.
And that's so, when dudes are hitting five, like
hitting five lug nuts. We had a kid that could hit five lug nuts in 0.48 seconds.
Jesus.
Fails at everything else in life, but hitting lug nuts is unbelievable. But you know, like we started, like you said, you start getting NFL linebackers, and we got this kid that Dabo Swinney built Clemson around. And I remember him running around the car the first day, and I remember looking at Mike and be like, I don't even know if I can coach that because I've never seen that, because he was so dynamic and explosive, right? So, and that just continues to ratchet up. We just got a kid through the doors the other day that has every single running back record in Pennsylvania, was in the running backs room with Saquon Barkley and Miles Sanders, And this kid, I've never seen a human being move like this before. Like, it is stunning. And, you know, 6'2", can dunk a basketball standing flat footed under the rim. Like, he's just a different type of human being.
How do you find these guys? You're both shaking your head like,
You know, I think is we look for stories. You know what I mean? Like, we don't care if you led the SEC in rushing, right? We don't care if you led the ACC in free throws or home runs. We don't care about that stuff, right? We want, like I said, world-class human beings. What is that, right? We have a female soccer player who left Paris and came and played D1 at West Virginia. Could you imagine going from Paris, France to Morgantown, West Virginia? Like, can you imagine that? So, like, that just speaks to something, right? The kid from Pennsylvania, when Saquon left for the league, he was going to be the featured back. They do physical testing. They find a heart defect in him. He's done. He can never touch a football ever again in his life, right? So this kid has every reason to be angry at the world because it cost him millions of dollars, right? He should be a millionaire. And he dances through the front door every day. Right. I think Mike and I thought early on, if we're going to spend 80 or 90 hours a week at this, we want to do it with people we enjoy being around. And people you enjoy being around are good experience. They're hard workers. They're intrinsically motivated. So we went after those things.
The kid from Penn State, his name's Journey Brown. And it took a couple times for Sean to call him and say, hey, man, we'd like to, we got connected to him. Once he finally agreed to come visit, the program kind of sold itself. Like, he saw people that looked like him. It's a diverse group. We've got Caps, our oldest tire changer. He's 44. And then there's kids that are fresh out of high school. There's people with master's degrees and people that can barely put sentences together. I mean, it's like we got a little bit of everything, but from a competition standpoint and a collaboration standpoint, it's an environment that when you walk into it, you're like, man, this is something that I would want to be a part of. And that's how we get kids. It's culture. And I know that's a word that gets thrown around a lot, but it's important and it matters.
Do you guys, I mean, I know yours is sort of unique to your team, your program, but could the same be said for all the other teams in NASCAR? I mean, do you find that this is something that is, I guess I'll say, industry-wide, or is this unique to you guys? Is it what sets your team apart?
No, I think we're looking for different things in other teams. Other teams are looking for the kid that led the SEC in touchdown passes, right? They're looking at your 40 time and your 5-10-5 and all that stuff. We're not, you know what I mean? And I think that's what differentiates us. And you guys got to understand, like, when Mike and I took this program over, it was outside the top 25. And we were asked to compete with the Gibbses and Hendrick of the world, right? And we were asked to do that with half the budget. So the only way we were going to compete with the other teams is if we weaponized our culture, right? If we looked at it and reinvented it and built it in the aggregate, right? That was how we were going to close the gap. So first couple of years, we get the thing into the top 15, then it's in the top 10, then it's the top 5, won NASCAR's Best Picker Award last year, right? So it's just basically rethinking what could this look like. Like, Mike and I were both pit crew athletes for years, and I don't think it was that we thought we could be great pit crew coaches. I think we just thought, hey, I think we can do it better than what we're experiencing.
But, you know, to that point, it's kind of what you guys were saying earlier, like there's this shift happening, and now all these people that have other types of skill sets are coming into a new environment. So it was people that were, you know, JV football coaches. One guy was a good manager at a grocery store. And like, so all these guys are pit crew coaches now, and like, they don't know what they're doing. They saw a couple of races. They were excited about it. Somebody needed a job. There was an open position. And so some of the people that we learned from were interesting.
So Mike talked about the importance of culture. Sean talked about weaponizing culture. So I got to ask the question directly. What is the 12-second culture?
It's inspiring human brilliance by valuing people. I think that would be the best way to surmise it. So, you know, I think, and you that can, you can do that a myriad of ways. I think, you know, two of the things that Mike and I were most successful with is, when we were building it, we were putting in a lot of long hours, right? And we were asking a lot of people. So one thing that we really tried to hang our hat on is, you know, when we were driving home after a long day, we would call someone on the way home. We just called it the after work phone call, because every phone call you've ever received from your boss after work hours is bad news. Right. And we would just call people up and be like, hey, you know, your hard work doesn't go unrecognized. Thank you. Thanks for everything you're doing to move this program forward. Right. And they're probably receiving it. Their wife's there, their kids, you know what I mean? Like it, you catch someone unexpectedly. And when you catch someone unexpectedly, there's tremendous power there. Right. You know, we stole a thing from Tom Osborne, who used to coach University of Nebraska. He had a Rolodex on his desk, and it had every important date of every one of his football players' lives. Now, I hate phones, right? They're the bane of my existence, but they can be used for good. So what we did is on the intake form, we asked for your birthdays, which every company knows. We asked for your parents' birthdays. We asked for your anniversaries. We had all of it, right? And our phones are set to alert us before we go to practice. So literally, I can have 26 athletes warming up at practice, and I can put my hand on someone's shoulder and be like, hey, don't forget to call your dad. It's his birthday today. I promise you, almost, I more odds to not, no one's ever done that for them. You know, and you start, these people start realizing, wow, these people are invested in us more than just athletes, right? They care about us. And when you start getting 100% of someone, that's what inspiring human brilliance looks like. And then you start, you have 24 people operating at 100%, you're going to beat 50 people operating at 20.
And all three of those words are important, like inspiring. We talk about how it's so hard to mandate greatness or excellence. You know, hey, we suck last year, let's go win the championship this year. Like, everybody wants to win a championship. Like, how are we going to do that? And then we figured out, like, you got to inspire that kind of behavior. Like, if people are inspired and can become passionate and excited about what the cause is and what the goals are, and then just how we plan to do it, like knowing what the plan is, well, that's different. It's different than just saying, go be great. You know, human, like Sean talked about, determination theory, talking about how you got to be competent at what you're doing, be authentic in who you are, and have meaningful connections with others in order to be successful. And so a third of that ability to be successful has that intersection of like we having meaningful relationships along the way. And then brilliance, I mean, is never achieved through the rat race. It's never achieved through just beating your head on the wall. It's unplugging, it's taking walks, it's taking breaks, it's making sure people are emotionally healthy and in a good place. It's looking out for teammates, it's being open and honest and transparent about where you are and what you need. And so each one of those things, I think, is what kind of builds our culture.
There's a fast one in there that I got to mention. I remember having a conversation with Drew a few months ago, and he pointed out to me that like nothing important ever happens during meetings. All the important stuff gets accomplished in like chance meetings in the hallway and things like that. And I think about that comment.
I learned that from NASCAR
all the time. Yeah.
That's not true.
I've been in those meetings. I know you didn't learn it from NASCAR.
Can I ask, I mean, I want to get back to, you know, sort of you guys' four principles, but prior to that, I keep thinking of the movie Moneyball. And for people that haven't seen it, I'm not even going to give a synopsis, just go watch it. It's fantastic. But you mentioned that you guys were pretty low down the list when you started in terms of team performance and where you ranked relative to everyone else. I would imagine that there were conversations with leadership of your organization about how that shift is going to take place. And if I can call your approach unorthodox, I would imagine that maybe there was some of that going on as you sort of rose through the ranks, because like you mentioned, you were recruiting for people, not necessarily high speed athletes. And that was just sort of a byproduct. Was there any convincing that needed to take place on behalf of you guys sort of up the chain, or did everyone buy into this pretty early on once you started, I suppose, achieving some success, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think Mike and I were questioned every step of the way. But I think what saved us is we were performing at an elite level when they came to us and asked us if we would take over their program. It put us in a position where we could dictate the terms. And we said flat out, look, this is going to look different. If Chip Ganassi walks outside of the building and we're playing basketball, you need to defend me for that. You know, if we're not doing 100 pit stops a day after a bad race, you have to defend, you know what I mean? So we kind of laid out terms about what that would look like. But no, we were questioned. You know, that we had a kid You know, Mike mentioned his name's Kenyatta Houston. He is energy defined. And he was in this building before and did not leave well. You know, when he was there, he had dreadlocks and, you know, his chains and stuff like that. And he was a good tire changer, but wasn't great. Well, we bring him back in and they question Mike and I right off the bat. They're like, really? We don't have a great relationship with him. So we start rolling and we get this car in the top 10. And our boss comes up to us and says one day, he says, you know what? Ever since Kenyatta Houston cut his dreadlocks off, he's got a lot more serious and way better at this. It had nothing to do with the dreadlocks, right? It had everything to do with people believing in him, giving him the opportunity and the right tools and building the environment around him in which he could be successful, right? Yeah. So yeah, I mean, believe me, like the diversity part of deck, no other team in NASCAR history looks like ours. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that doesn't come without some difficult conversations, some threats of violence. Like it was a trip.
that same GM at one point was like, you guys are never going to make it. Cause I mean, one of the first things we did was fire the best tire changers we had, and, you know, but he wasn't buying in, entitled, selfish, you know, wanting to do his own way. And we're like, hey, we're moving in a different direction. The things that you guys are doing isn't working, you know. And you look at a guy like Kenyatta, it's that quote that if a flower is broken, you don't try to fix the flower. You fix the environment the flower's in, right? So we had to change the environment in order to be successful. And yeah, it was rough. I mean, there were days where Chip Ganassi would walk outside, or a president or the crew chief or something, and somebody, hey, Mike, Chip's over there. And I'm like, who's Chip? They're like, I didn't know how to respond to that. I'm like, keep playing, let's go, we're playing basketball, this is what we're doing right now. And eventually they realize, like, okay, Mike and Sean are pretty serious about this. And then it's one of those things, man, you either believe it or you don't. You either believe it or you don't. Like, and we were like, hey, this is what we're gonna do, this is our strategy, this is our plan, and if it doesn't work, fire us, but until then, this is how we're moving forward. And it not really sure why, for a couple of meatheads, but fortunately it worked out.
We're the first ones in the buildings and the last out, right? So I think sometimes too, that buys you some grace, right? Because they know you're about it. They know you're trying to build it. And it's been interesting.
I mean, you guys have touched on this through both of those explanations, but I mean, I got to just dig a little bit deeper, because the corollary to what is happening in the military and specifically in the Army right now is fascinating, in the sense that we're living in a culture change. There's a new PT test going on. They're starting to bring in civilians to run PT. Like, you're seeing a world where there's a shift from this old school, like you mentioned, just doing tons of pit stops a day. Same exact thing exists for us. Like, just doing quote unquote tactical stuff every single day. How dare you run slow? Why would you ever do this when you could just throw on a kit and do all of this? Injury rates, et cetera, et cetera. Everything you would expect, right? In a culture of just like old school meat grinders. So my question, or maybe the discussion point for you guys, is like, what were some key lessons learned when it came to culture change? You mentioned that you were sort of telling people, like, or you had maybe a lot of leeway to showcase what you were bringing to the table, but like you mentioned, there was a lot of challenges in that too. So I'm just curious, like, specifically, what were some of the lessons learned that maybe a young leader could take from this when they're right in the middle of changing culture?
Yeah, I think two things, and I'll start and then pass it over to Mike. I think two things that served us well. First, was that Mike and I were not pit crew coaches when we took the job, right? We were pit crew athletes. And what we realized is we wouldn't have the answers for everything. So what we did realize, though, is if we brought in the right people and we elevated voices, right, that there is a good idea in the room, right? So that if the people we brought in was a diverse mix, someone would sit at the table with the key to unlock the answer that we didn't have, right? So by elevating people and elevating their voices, didn't matter if you're on campus for 6 weeks or 6 years, a good idea is a good idea, and we want to hear it, okay? And then the second one was approaching it with an unmistakable degree of humility, right? We walked to the doors every day and it wasn't, what do we know? I think the question we would always ask ourselves is, what do we know that no longer serves us? And I think that's what sounds more of what's going on in the military right now. Mm-hmm. You know, Mike and I call it the disease of nostalgia. We've always done it this way, right? Like that archaic way of thinking is just, that's about burying teams, companies, and programs, right? It's having the humility to say, you know what? I've always thought about this. I might need to rethink this because it no longer serves us, you know, especially post-COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would just say that fortune favors the brave. I mean, we had to kind of, to Sean's point, the whole idea of like sunk costs, like just because we started this program or this thing, we got to stick to it. Like we say fail quickly all the time. Like if it's not working, change it, you know? And then a lot of that comes to do with changing the people, you know? And it's one of my favorite quotes is change the people or change the people, right? So the people that kind of get you there aren't going to necessarily be the people that keep you there. So a lot of times there's going to be a group that's okay to kind of rebuild and transition and change, but they may not be the ones that can get you. So the people that got us outside the top 20, inside the top 10 towards the P5 is not the same group that won Pit Crew of the Year last year. You know, a couple of the guys, but three were completely different. Right. And so just being able to change, you know, people, Sean talks about a lot where, you know, we can handle, we're built to handle change. You know, mm-hmm. It's consequences that come with change that get people a little, you know, rocky, but people are okay with changing. You just got to kind of push them into the right direction.
Yeah. I love the fail fast comment because, I mean, we've mentioned it on here multiple times with multiple guests, just this idea of path dependency. And I mean, we see it in strength and conditioning. Every single time someone pulls out a Russian textbook about how to squat. But I mean, for you guys, you blew right through that. And it's something that we as human performance professionals, but more broadly, I think as the military struggle with big time. So that's definitely interesting.
Right. And the fail quickly part, right? You think about what we're doing, right? In a lot of ways, it parallels what you do. And some of the things you guys do operate right on the verge of what's humanly possible. Like some of the asks are pretty tall, right? And we have to understand is that as human beings, we're all fallible, right? But so many of us still look at failure as the monster under the bed. And it's not, right? Like you look at all the formative things in your life, a lot of those things have been built by failure. Mm-hmm. The monster under the bed is compounding failure, right? So what we always ask, like Mike said, our athletes do is to fail quickly. So if the race car comes down pit road, you mess up the right side, fail quickly and be great on the left side. Or if you fail first stop of the race, fail quickly and be great the rest of the race. Cause we can handle that, right? We're going to Nashville this weekend. We already know we're going to fail going into the weekend. It's how we meet that and move through it that's going to determine whether we're successful or not. So I think, you know, the one thing we can add is just as human beings, we need to allow ourselves the grace to fail and move on. Because if we don't, it compounds. And then it's your 8 o'clock meeting and your 9 o'clock meeting and you take it into your 10 and then the afternoon, you know what I mean? Like, we're not going to throw a no-hitter in life. It's just, that's the facts. That's the facts of the whole thing, right?
I was looking through some of your guys' stuff before we got on here, and you do talk a lot about like failure tolerance and how to get past it and things like that. And I was listening to an interview with an Army senior leader just less than a week ago, I think. And he made a point about how he learned more from his failures than he ever did from his successes across the course of his career. And I think helping reinforce that mindset of like failure does not mean anything negative about the team or what you're trying to do. It's the opportunity to learn that comes from it. I think keeping people in that mindset.
But see, I think, I mean, okay. So I just have to pause here because I hear senior leaders, and this doesn't necessarily have to just be an Army commentary, but like you hear senior leaders say that all the time. But when you're a junior person on a team, pit crew, military, whatever, when you fail, seldom is the opportunity actually set up for you to reap success from that failure. Like you are more often than not punished for it. And so it's just interesting to hear this stuff happen at the highest levels. And it makes for great books and great quotes on posters of eagles and things like that. But like, I don't know, not a question there so much as just a commentary of like, how do you trickle that down to the lowest level to where failure is actually like a learnable lesson and not like, hey, go out and freaking rake the sticks out of the forest for the next 4 days because you failed.
Well, and that's just it. And that's something they may have to rethink, right? Because human brilliance and failure like butt up to one each other, right? Like you're never going to be exceptional if you never fail because you're never going to know where the line is, right? And I think, you know, in the way you talk to people, right? And I think that may be something they need to rethink. Mike says it all the time. your words can be a sword or a scalpel, right? And one's built to maim, the other's built to heal. They both cut. One's built to maim, one's built to heal, right? And it's making sure people understand the lesson without dehumanizing them, right? So that they are inspired to do better, right? So they keep pushing, so they keep digging, right? You rip the initiative out of someone, they're never going to fail again, but they're never going to be the best version of themselves either.
Especially as we get younger generations, you know, the bulldozer parents that kind of move obstacles out of the past. You know, I was just talking to a young lady that was a college athlete and kind of fizzled out of a program. Man, she was saying how her club team, they killed everybody. She never lost a game, but then gets into the ACC and it's hard. Everybody's good. You know, everybody's prepared. People are coming at you on your team. They want to take your spot, you know? And so it's, you know, I think we need to put a lot of thought into how we communicate what failure is, how we, like Sean said, how we respond to that, how we grow from that, because generationally we respond to things differently. You can come in and yell and scream and call me all kind of names, and I'm going to say, okay, cool. And I'm going to show up tomorrow and keep working. You do that to somebody that's 22, they may not, they probably won't respond the same way. Right. And so I think there just needs to be some of these books are generational. Some of these generals are generational.
Yeah. It's cool you guys came to that as the conclusion there, because like the follow-on question to that guy, because he's about to retire, he's wrapping up a long career, and they asked him what he regrets, and the comment he made was that he wished he had tried more things that he thought he might fail, because it can be scary to like throw yourself into things where there's a high chance of failure, and he wishes he had like tried and failed at more things, because that's where the value was.
Well, and that's the problem with most of us, right? Like so many of us are capable of so much more, right? But we succumb to self-limiting beliefs, usually formed from other people's opinions of us, and it affects how far we rise. And if you're not willing to fail, right? It's not, this was put to us by one of our athletes. The problem is, it's not that you aim too high and you miss, it's that you aim too low and you hit, and you think that's the best there is for you. Right. And that guy is a perfect example. He thought at the end he could have done so much better, but he wasn't willing to take that big shot. He took the small shot and hit and thought, yeah, I'm kicking ass. And he was capable of so much more. And that goes for so many of us.
Do you guys see that? I would imagine you see that quite a bit in your line of work, because you've talked about these pretty high speed athletes coming from pretty, you know, accomplished backgrounds. And I would imagine that you can see these folks achieve this new level of success just from changing a tire, and just sort of the joy, satisfaction, whatever, of kind of discovering this new element of themselves. Is that something that you guys see quite a bit?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like I said, you see a guy light up who's already won a Super Bowl with the Denver Broncos, and he's pumped because he just ran an 8-second stop. You're like, really? Like really? Is that, you know? So it's yeah, I think you do. It's creating purpose for these people that are at the end of the road athletically, right? And they're not built to go sit under, you know, artificial light. So, you know, when it lands, yeah, it's a cool moment. And some of them get there and some of them don't, you know? And it's, you can tell the ones that had to struggle and work hard to be excellent at their sports, because that skill set translates to use the successful ones that Mike and I see.
So I want to give you guys a chance to go through, because this is deck leadership, right? And I want to give you guys a chance to break down the four principles there. And we'll do them one by one, but I want to add a layer to the diversity one before you guys jump into it, because there's like traditional obvious diversity stuff. But some of what you were discussing before got me thinking about like diversity of viewpoint and diversity of opinion and those things as well. So I want you to kind of fold that in there, because one thing I've looked at a lot, and there's actual research on this in military special operations settings, is that when you have teams of people that do different things, like an interdisciplinary team, the value, like the tangible, measurable value of the psychological safety to bring different viewpoints is like very much critical to some of these operations, more so than a lot of people would think. So we talk about it a lot with strength coaches, working with athletic trainers, working with physical therapists, working with all these other professions. So both the like diversity in the traditional sense and the diversity of viewpoint stuff. I'd love to hear about your approach to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's diversity for us is building a team. Efficiency is becoming a team, building trust. Culture is being a team. How do we exist together each day on a daily basis? And then kindness is the glue that ties it all in. It's more than a team. It's becoming something bigger than just a group of people trying to achieve a certain outcome. Diversity, we had a team acronym, and it's a diversity of thought, experience, age, and motor. I forgot to spell team. Diversity of thought, experience, age, and motor. And so thought process. Like we talked about how, you know, if I had six black Mustangs, six white Mustangs, do I have a diverse car collection? No, like it's so much bigger and deep. You got 12 Mustangs, right? It's deeper than color and optics, things that we can see. It's stuff that's a lot more intrinsic. And yeah, I mean, if I ask people all the time, do you have a diversified stock portfolio or a 401k plan? And everybody's like, absolutely. You know, what would be the point of having a homogenous portfolio or fund? Because if all your eggs are in one basket and that one basket sinks, you're screwed, right? But if we have some balance, right? If we have some strength, then I just say that's all diversity is, it's wholeness. And time after time, metric after metric shows that diverse teams are like 35% more efficient, right? They have the ability to see around corners that other teams don't. They have ability to bring in different experiences and weigh those experiences and use those experiences as leverage and as momentum. And so, yeah, experience. So age, we talk about, you need young people, you need old people, some of that, you know, veteran wisdom, you know, but then some of that youthful energy, right? You need that balance. You also need people that are veterans in the industry, and then you need people that don't know anything about it. We love having people that are like, man, I don't know anything about NASCAR. Can I still do it? Absolutely. Because you're going to see it with new eyes. You're going to ask questions that none of us are thinking to ask because we've been here so long and talked about that unlearning part of it. That's where that comes in. People that can challenge you in different ways. Motor, different personalities, right? That's like what's driving you. Some people are money driven. That's okay. We have a bonus program. They're going to get after it, right? Some people love our community aspects. They want to interact with people. And some people are just competitive, and some people are quiet. Some people are loud. And some, I mean, it's just, we want all of it. And for us, it's like, man, a big box of crayons with 64 different colors. And if you're trying to draw a picture with three or four colors and I've got 64, man, I'm gonna be able to draw something a lot more beautiful than you, right? And so that's just our approach to diversity, and it's working, man. It's a performance strategy. That's what we try to tell people. This isn't optics. It's not coming out of the hills of 2020. People wanted to ask us all kind of questions about how do you do this, and we're like, go talk to somebody else, man. We've been here 8 years, you know, like, don't try to act like we're new to this. Like, this is how we roll. So yeah, diversity has been a huge, honestly, blessing for us.
How do you recruit for diversity? I mean, is it a question of sort of hoping that a diverse pool of applicants comes to whatever you have available? Or do you guys go out and seek those attributes that you just sort of ran through?
We don't, I think more is we don't put limiters on any of it, right? We don't just let D1 athletes come through the door. We don't let athletes come through the door. We don't just let, you know what I mean? It's open to everyone, you know? And I think people will slot themselves into roles that we don't have fulfilled, right? So it's really them showing up and showing out. But I think the big thing is us, anyone in the country can come and try out at Trackhouse Racing. Right. You know, it's not a combine where only 24 people are invited. Right. Anyone in the country, we'll take anyone, but you're going to have to navigate our first day's experience. And what we do is we disguise the behaviors we want to see in people so that, you know, we're getting someone that we think we can work with. So I think, there was a really great example put to us, and it was a friend of ours out in Silicon Valley. And he ran a group. And this group was the picture of diversity, split equal male, female, couple Asian, couple African-American, couple Indian, couple LGBTQ+, you name it, like the poster board for diversity, right? 14 of them were Hillary supporters at the time. One was a Trump guy, and they ran the Trump guy out of the building. That's not diversity. It's not. You know what I mean? And that's what we've always guarded against, right? If we're, you know, if we look like that and we're all from the same fraternity house, we probably think all exactly the same way. So, you know, I think when we brought people in, we would find people that are that complement the group, and they might complement the group because they're more athletic, or they're really loud when they come in, or they're more introspective when they come in, or, you know what I mean? So I think, like I said, I think it was just a lot of those behaviors showing up. And then, and like I said, if we don't elevate the voices in our program, we don't even know what that diversity is. Right. If we just come in and say, hey, you're part of the program, you work, keep your mouth shut. We don't tap into that diversity. So I think, like I said, elevating voices is a huge part of the diversity aspect. We put nothing above being a world-class human being, and we're almost split 50-50 the way we look.
So that gives a pretty good start to like how you bring the team together and what attributes you look for and how that all fits. But efficiency seems to be how you get that diverse group of people with a diverse group of perspectives all pointed in the same direction after the same mission. How do you guys define efficiency with DEC, and what does it mean for you guys?
Yeah, I think, you know, for us, the goal was never to be perfect in the end. It was to be better tomorrow, right? It was the aggregation of marginal gains. Like that's what was going to close the gap on all these other teams, right? So it was, you know, efficiency of movement. It was us looking at everything that lent itself to our success. So everything from tooling, how we were eating, how we were moving, who was training us, what kind of mental space we were in, how were we recovering, like everything. And it was, you know, like I said, if we got our nutrition 5% better and our guns got 2% better, right? It was the aggregation, all those marginal gains that when we brought it back, wow, we just went from outside the top 25 to the top 20. Well, then we break it apart again. Okay, what can we work on? You know, and coaching efficiency, you think about it. We look at pit stops for, you know, every day for 3 months. And if we get 0.2 seconds better, that's a good 3 months for us. But you can also understand what a curse that is when you go to the smoothie store and the cash register's here and the blender's down here and the bananas are over here. And you see this, you know what I mean? You're just like, what are we doing? You know, what are we doing? So, yeah. I mean, and you look at it and they become efficient in everything. Right. And it's just interesting when you watch some of them that are about it, even the way their luggage gets on the plane, like it's efficiency. You just, it's something you end up living.
It's a lifestyle. I mean, efficiency always is some way connected to some sort of bottom line. And so we just wanted to create a lot of wins early. And a couple quotes that we kind of lived by early were that proof of desire is in pursuit, and then that the routine is a reward. And so we weren't trying to necessarily go out and be the best team. We're in the 20s. All right. We're not expecting you to go and beat number one, Joe Gibbs and Hendrick right now. But like kind of to Sean's point, if we can be 2% better tomorrow, right? If we can start chipping away at the wood that we got, if we can fall in love with a routine that we know is going to get us to where we are able to do that at some point. And then if we can prove to each other that we all desire this and we're going to go after it together, we'll get there, right? And that was the thing that really built trust with us early. We started doing a ton of volunteering in the community, just trying to create purpose and perspective beyond just being faster. We weren't, you know, curing cancer or doing, you know, we're not splitting atoms here, right? We're changing tires and putting gas in cars. Being able to get out in the community and help and serve people that were maybe having some tougher times with life, tougher than not being in the top five, created perspective, right? And so those were the things that I think really brought us together in the early days.
Just out of curiosity, what were those other teams? I mean, like what is a top team? What are they doing? It's so different. I mean, obviously the budget thing you guys mentioned early on, but what was it that you were pursuing in terms of this efficiency push?
Oh, I mean, we were getting beat by teams that, you know, they were trying to get more spin rate on the end of their socket. So instead of going from a metal socket, they were machining their own titanium sockets. Right. We didn't have that. We didn't have the budget. Our exotic metals budget was an eighth of what other teams were, which actually served us well, because one of the things they didn't realize is that titanium spark is 8 times hotter than a regular spark. So when you're hitting lug nuts right under the fuel that's spilling out of the race car, they sent one up like an Olympic torch at Richmond. And we were like, wow, thank God we were poor. We didn't burn up all our athletes. You know, so it's just, it was all over the place, right? So you're trying to, okay, I'm going to get outmoneyed here, here, and here. Okay, how can I overcome that, right? It's with kids that cared more, right? You keep throwing money at people, at some point, the money's going to be more than, you know, it's not going to be enough,
mm-hmm.
right? And we thought, okay, let's get these kids that want to be part of something bigger than just, it's not the money you get paid while you're in it, it's what you leave with. Right. And let's, you know, it was investing in the kids in our program instead of just giving them a big contract for 2 years and then kicking them out. It was like, no, we're in the long haul with you. You know, we want to build something that's sustainable. So and unlike under other sports, we can have athletes for a decade. You know, that's not uncommon.
So as I was looking through your guys' stuff before this, one of the quotes that stood out is, if you want a more efficient environment, people must be elevated over processes. And it stood out to me because coming from the military world, it sounds a lot like soft truth number one. So if you guys ever get around like special operations forces stuff, they have the soft truths. There are five of them. And we're soft cool. truth number one is that humans are more important than hardware.
That one.
I mean, look cool is it comes first, but we got it. But just the idea, like seeing some of these cultural things parallel each other in environments as different as NASCAR and the military, just seeing like some things kind of shake out as universal truths and valuing the members of your team, whether it's changing tires or going to war, seems to be like a just foundational requirement to building an effective team.
It is. I just read a book. It was about, I can't remember the title. It was about a couple soldiers that won every Medal of Valor in World War II. And just the things they did to do that, right? That had nothing to do with what equipment they were using, what guns they were shooting, what grenades they're. It was just this. It was internal. It was intrinsic, right? And that's just it, right? It's building people and making that investment into people, and like you said, making them feel valued, right? Making them feel like, hey, you know, we are thrilled that you're here, and we're better because you're here. Right. And not just, I get it. There's a whole psychological element to tearing people down and bringing them back up. But I think, you know, like Mike said earlier, this is a different type of kid that's coming. You know, it's just a different type of person. And you better figure out how to adapt and inspire that human brilliance instead of just trying to beat it into them, because it leads to two different things.
So as we work our way through deck here, culture's next, but I almost feel like we've talked about the culture piece. Is there anything you guys want to add on that one?
No, I think we've covered it pretty good there.
Culture eats strategy for breakfast. That's just legendary quote. And it was true 50 years ago. It's still true now. You can have the best plan in the world, but if you don't have people that are bought in, that are excited to be there, it's not going to matter.
I want to ask a culture question before we jump to the next one, because, and we may have just touched on this as you guys were walking through efficiency, but one of the things you hear in the military all the time is people first. I mean, you hear it in every organization, people first. That briefs well, it sells a lot of products if you're in sort of the corporate space, but I think we've all also seen at the end of the day, more often than not, processes actually trump people. And I will never forget when I was working with the Air Force, you know, a new leader took over. This wasn't someone I worked directly for. It was many, many, you know, echelons above me. But his thing was people first, mission always, which fundamentally made no sense. Because if people are first, but the mission is always, then at some point, mission is going to trump people. And you guys have talked about people and culture basically since the beginning. It's sort of the foundational principles that you guys have built your organization on. How do you truly put people first, and what has that looked like for you guys in an environment as fast paced? And, you know, we mentioned it, millions of dollars are at stake.
It means fighting for them, right? We talked about how human beings are fallible. We had a kid early on who was an incumbent in the building, and he thought he was going to be the jackman on one of the top cars. And this other kid outworked him, outperformed him, and we delivered the news to him. Went back to his desk, and he fires a pen through his computer, shatters his whole thing, and they wanted us to let him go, right? And that wasn't the lesson, right? And we were like, no, we're gonna fight for you, but this is what we're gonna do to be successful. We're gonna manage our emotions first. So when you get bad news, we're gonna react with the grace of an adult, not the grief of a child. And we're going to understand that you put this many people out in the IT department. So what you're going to do is you're going to take them to lunch, buy them all lunch, and then we're going to move forward together, right? Instead of just ushering the kid out of the building, right? Like, that's what putting people first is. It's not, well, protocol is if you vandalize equipment, then you're out of the building. It's not. It's not. I mean, sometimes it might have to be that, but there's always a lesson that can be, you know what I mean? We're so quick. I think so many of us judge others by their actions and we judge ourselves by our intentions, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I would have done this. Yeah, but you weren't in that situation, right? So I think putting people first is fighting for people in your building, right? Because again, we're going to make missteps. Things aren't going to go our way. We're going to react poorly, right? Do you just discount, dismiss, and discard those people? Or do you teach them, value them, and build them?
So you're getting real close to the final part of deck here. So we'll just lay it out, which is kindness. And I thought it was interesting because, like, when I picture people jumping over a wall and running around a car and changing tires and things like that, kindness is not the thing that comes to mind, right? It doesn't seem to be at the forefront. And I think people would probably say something very similar about, like, what the military looks like from the outside. You wouldn't expect kindness to be a big part of the equation. What led you to making it one of your primary four principles?
Yeah, I mean, kindness is the glue that kind of binds us all together as humans, right? So we need that glue. We need that connection. We have the same kind of team, kind of acronym, and it's transparency, empathy, action, and more. And so transparency, you know, just being open and honest where you are. We had a couple times where we kind of had some groups not working well together. And after several missed opportunities on pit road, missed chance at winning races, slower pit stops, finally get two guys talking, saying, man, his shoulders are in the way. I can't see the lug nut pattern. Or his knee's in the way. And these are both football guys, right? So they're bigger people. They're maybe used to working with guys that are smaller. And now we've got all these big studs, right? And so it's like, all right, cool. Thank you for that transparency. James, can you move your knee in a little bit? Yeah, I think I can do that. Will, can you back your shoulder out a little bit? Yeah, I think I can do that. And now all of a sudden, there we go. We're 3/10 faster. And so transparency is a form of kindness. It's a willingness to be vulnerable and let people know what you need. That leads to performance. Empathy leads to performance. Being able to understand, hey, I had a rough night, or I'm going through a tough time. I'm trying to be present right now, but it's hard because I'm going through some stuff. You know, can you guys help carry me today? You know, instead of setting up, can I go make some calls back home? You know, and not be like, hey, man, we're doing all the work here. You know, like, these kind of moments can be so tender and can lead to performance, right? Action. You can't be kind to others if you're not kind to yourself. I mean, we talk so much about how we need to show up and invest through overflow. We need to pour out of our lives and into the lives of others, you know, in order, you know, for others to be inspired and empowered and those kind of things, especially as leaders. If we come in and we're flat, our teams are going to be flat, right? But if we come in full, excited, happy to be there, able to give something, then that's reflected in the performance and the teams that we're leading. And then more, like, there's never a bad day to be kind to somebody, you know, it's never like, oh, it just wasn't convenient, you know, like, just go for it, right? So many times the world is busy and rushed and cold and transactional. And if we can take moments, even if it's just at work, something simple as a drill or a workout or a film review, and have a kind moment, man, that can be sometimes often the best parts of our day. And so if we can create many little ripples effects of kindness each and every day, we have a chance to continue to invest in that culture, to build that trust and allow that diversity to come in a really beautiful, powerful way.
Yeah. I think the only thing I would add is that, you know, humility and kindness are the key ingredients in abundance, right? And NASCAR pit crews are a true example of an abundance mindset. You know, we say to the guys and girls all the time, you know, we use this quote, and it's from abundance, I took abundance, and still abundance remained. Right. What happens to a lot of us is, due to proximity, we compete with one another. Right. Like, you all in the Army should not be competing with each other. You actually shouldn't even be competing with the Marines and the Coast Guard. You guys should be competing with China and Russia, you know what I mean? But because of proximity, we compete with one another, right? And there's a scarcity mindset that comes with that. There's only one general position. There's only one corner office. There's only one. So what we do is we climb over people to get those, right? And what abundance is, a pit crew is five athletes. If four of them are 8-second athletes and one of them's an 11-second athlete, you have an 11-second pit crew. And, you know, so many of the big jumps in time, you know, NASCAR pit stops used to be in excess of a minute, 30 seconds. We have them down to 8 seconds. But a lot of the big jumps in time were when people did something that wasn't their job, right? Like a jackman one time just reached in and pulled the tire. That's not his job, but he did it because he made the whole thing faster. So what we want is kindness leads to abundance, right? So instead of being in the army and fighting over our pieces of the pie, what if we all just came together and worked to make the pie bigger? Then everyone wins, right? It's amazing what we can do if we just go. There's so much out there in the world if we just decide to go together and go get it.
Well, I got to ask you guys sort of the two-parter obvious follow-up to this, because we walked through the four components: diversity, efficiency, culture, kindness. Which of those do you find that teams are often most successful at, and which do they struggle with most on aggregate?
Companies struggle with diversity the most. You know, it's, we've been on enough calls where I'm just like, oh man, I know exactly what your problem is. what do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I'd say the first one or the last one. Yeah. The diversity, kind of just having a healthy understanding of it. You know, it's not, oh God, here goes the neighborhood. It's, you know, it's a real understanding of we need differences at the table, and our differences can be uniting factors and strengths as opposed to things that take us apart. I think that's the natural fear, is if we get, you know, too many different people's voices at the table, we won't be able to come to a consensus. And it's actually the opposite of that. And then it's the kindness piece. I think people think that, you know, if I show any sort of kindness, that that's weakness. If I show any sort of, you know, empathy, then people will think I'm weak and stomp all over me. So I can't have that. So I got to swing it the other way and I got to be a dick. And then that's going to be the way that I lead people, and people are going to be really excited and happy to work with me. And it's like, no, it's not. That makes no sense. Right. So, yeah, I would say people tend to see us and say, oh, 12-second culture, we can get faster. And they're efficiency people. They're thinking about process. And then, like, a lot of people already have that. There's so much out there, Six Sigma and all this stuff about how to refine processes over time. I think people have read enough Simon Sinek books to understand that culture matters. But it's those first two that are kind of the bookends to hold those other two in the middle together. And without all four working, you're not going to be fast in your organization. You know, this is a formula for speed, and that's where we're at. And that's our story, and that's our journey.
So you guys have the convenient factor. If you can time a very specific task, and that will tell you how effective your team is at that particular thing. But when you zoom out and look at team dynamics and the diversity, efficiency, culture, kindness stuff, is there anything else that you've been able to like quantify and measure as you assess how a team is operating? Is that something you even try to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, like our team's the only team, the only pit crew in the history of NASCAR to win our sports version of the Walter Payton Award, which is the Comcast Community Champions Award. And it was born out of, you know, having guys do Meals on Wheels, which seeing a NASCAR team do Meals on Wheels is something in itself, right? Like, there's a speeding ticket every time we go, you know, someone's getting pulled over by the cops. It's like a cannonball run trying to get people food, you know, volunteering at the Charlotte Rescue Mission, you know, and it's Mike and I use it as a way to again, we talk about weaponizing culture. We try to weaponize perspective by doing that. And when you step back and look at it, like Mike said, at the end of the day, we're pitting race cars, right? And our job isn't national security. But when you step back and you look at it, those are the things I find you're most proud of, because you're like, you brought these people together, and it's a completely eclectic mix of people. And look at the light they put into the world. You know what I mean? That's when I swell. I don't swell anymore when we win the race off pit road. It doesn't light me up anymore. It's when I see these people, you know, put light into the world. I think that's my 1,000-foot view of it anyways.
So before I let you guys go, because we talked about kindness, and Sean, I know that you and I were connected somewhat serendipitously because you, I mean, I'll say you saved my mom and my sister's life, but you didn't actually, you changed some, I think you worked on their car, but can you tell that story? Because I told my mom I would have you do it. I don't want her to get mad at me. How did you guys meet?
Yeah. I think it was just divine, like an overruling providence. You know, we're in this tiny French village of Minerve in this hotel that's really obscure. There's only four guests at it, which is my wife and I and your mom and your sister. And we're going down for breakfast. And there was just a look of like consternation on your sister's face. And we just start talking. She's like, well, where are you from? And I said, oh, I'm from Davidson. And they're like, we're from Charlotte. So what are the chances of that? So we strike up a conversation. And obviously she felt comfortable enough to say, hey, I think I destroyed my car yesterday. Because like the streets over there are insanely narrow.
Rental car. I should point out rental car. She was freaking
rental
out.
Rental car, right? And she had more guts than I did. I parked mine outside of town and hiked all our luggage in because I was like, I'm not driving in this town. And So I just, you know, with my background, I'm like, oh, sure, I'll take a look at it. And I'm a big believer in the karmic arc of the universe, right? And my parents are on Vancouver Island, you know, 3,500 miles from here. So I just, whenever I can lend a hand, I do it because I hope it comes back to someone help my parents at some point. And it turned out to be a minor thing. I drove it and we were good to go. And I was just thrilled that it worked out, to be honest with you.
There you go. My mom and my sister wrecked their rental car in France, ended up with a world-class pit athlete helping them out.
Yeah, but they were so nice. We come back that night and there's a bottle of wine at our door. And like they went above and beyond, but they were, it was meant to happen because it led to all this.
That's perfect. Well, before we let you go, Sean and Mike, where can people go? I know we're going to plug your book, 12 Second Culture, but where can people go to find out more about you guys if they're interested?
Yeah, www.deckleadership.com. It has a link for our book, but there's a separate site, 12secondculturebook.com. And then we're on all the LinkedIns and the Twitters and Instagram, Deck Leadership. We post a good amount, you know, just try to give the people what they want, little quotes, you know, a couple times a week. It's fun.
Perfect. Well, thank you guys very much.
Awesome. Absolutely. Thanks. We'll see you guys. When you guys are up in Charlotte and you want to come to race, let us know. We'll make sure it happens.
Absolutely. Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in-depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.